From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, as the Department of Education aims to make cuts to Special Olympic funding, we look back at the woman who started it.
Her spirit is hanging over the Capitol right this moment, and it is enraged. You do not want to be in the path of Eunice Kennedy Shriver when she was enraged.
Also today, millennials of color stake their claim in Boston's art scene.
Certain genres and art disciplines get more love than others. Certain artists get featured all the time, and no one's really looking at the variety of people. It is my hope that people start taking us seriously.
And Ethan, a new film about an Amherst family and their son with autism.
My vision statement by Ethan Floque. After I graduate from high school, I plan to continue to go to Birch Hills Music Academy and work at Prospect Meadows Farm. I also have a girlfriend I'd like to add, also.
It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Let's start today with another battle in Washington, one that has a special resonance here in the Boston area. Federal funding for the Special Olympics is in jeopardy. President Trump's budget proposal includes a 10% cut in funding from Department of Education programs, and that would eliminate all the federal funding for Special Olympics, some $18 million. Now, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is facing sharp criticism from both Republicans and Democrats for supporting this cut. Here's Republican and former Ohio Governor John Kasich in a video he posted to Twitter.
Special Olympics was the standard by which we gave people hope and respect and ability to live their dreams. To cut funding from it, big mistake.
The pushback is also coming from Special Olympics Chairman Tim Shriver. Here he is on MSNBC.
The federal government, if it believes in full inclusion, and it does, our Constitution, our Declaration, and our laws tell us we do. And if the federal government has a role to support that, it ought to be investing in kids with special needs.
But this afternoon, Secretary Betsy DeVos pushed back against her critics at a Senate hearing.
It's been my responsibility to present the budget here on behalf of the administration, the president's budget. As I said then, and I'll say again, we had to make tough choices and decisions around the budget priorities.
And as we said, the Special Olympics have a particular resonance here in Massachusetts because they were founded by Eunice Kennedy Shriver. She was, of course, a member of the Kennedy clan. Her brothers were President John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and longtime Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. But Eileen McNamara, Pulitzer Prize-winning former columnist for the Boston Globe and the director of the journalism program at Brandeis University, wrote about the Special Olympics last year in her excellent biography, Eunice, the Kennedy Who Changed the World. So when we heard of the bipartisan backlash against these proposed cuts, we reached out to McNamara to get her reaction.
Betsy DeVos picked the fight with the wrong person and the wrong organization.
And why is that?
Special Olympics is an iconic charity in this country. It's benefited so many people. There are more than 5 million people with intellectual disabilities who participate in Special Olympics. The amount of money that the federal government gives to Special Olympics is only like 10% of their budget. Why would you X them out of a federal budget when it does so much good for so many people?
So let's talk about some of the good that it does for so many people, as you say, because I think sort of the outcry over these proposed spending cuts we've heard from Democrats and Republicans alike just shows how widespread and popular the Special Olympics have become. So in terms of the reach, what's the impact of the Special Olympics today?
Well, we saw the reach of the Special Olympics this month when they had World Games in Abu Dhabi. That's the first time we've had these games in the Mideast. It's a reflection of what Eunice Kennedy Shriver did. I mean, she kicked down doors all over the world to get attention paid to these children. She pulled them out of the shadows in places like China, the Middle East, South Africa, and she gave them an honored place on the playing field. She also had these countries start paying attention to their other needs, their educational needs, their physical needs. She really was the master of a revolution for those with intellectual disabilities.
And now today, I'm seeing that the Special Olympics has school programs in almost You know, 6,500 schools, according to their website, these programs have engaged nearly 3 million young people. You mentioned that this is just a small part of their budget. So $18 million, what impact would that loss have, in your view, on the Special Olympics?
Well, to exactly the kinds of programs you just described. I mean, it was the Special Olympics who said, let's put an end to the R word. And they launched that campaign in public schools all across the country to treat children with intellectual disabilities with respect. And you're going to take money away from that kind of a program. Their anti-bullying campaigns have helped so many children. They do physical work with these children. Do you know lots of pediatricians won't treat a child with Down syndrome? They don't want that child in their waiting room. So Special Olympics runs clinics to do vision testing, dental testing, all kinds of things for these kids that the regular medical system often closes them out of.
So, Eileen, they do a lot of good in the world today, and I wonder if we could actually take a step back here to when the organization was founded a half century ago, because just having something like this was a revolutionary idea, right?
It was absolutely a revolutionary idea. When she first formed the Special Olympics, it was called Camp Shriver in her backyard in 1962. Back in the 1960s, it's easy to forget, there was no special education. Children didn't have a right to a seat in a public school classroom until 1975. And they had that because of the Education for All Handicapped Children Act, which Eunice Kennedy helped write.
And you, as you write beautifully in your book, you know, it was largely through the sheer willpower of Eunice. Could you just remind us of her influence on politics and how she got this organization off the ground?
Special Olympics, in many ways, is almost the least of her accomplishments, because she put the needs and the problems of children with intellectual disabilities on the public agenda for the very first time. She influenced her brother, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy, to start a presidential panel on mental retardation. And within 2 years, she had legislation that he signed to eliminate those Dickensian institutions in which these children were once held and to get us on the path where they were entitled to a full public school education.
And Eileen and listeners, thank you for sticking with us through a slightly tough phone line here. But I'm wondering if you could also just tell us a little bit about some of the societal barriers that Eunice faced in getting this off the ground. Because as you mentioned, you know, the 60s was a different time, a different place than today.
A different time and a different place for women as well. I mean, Eunice Kennedy Shriver was the unseen force of nature in her own family. She got interested in this issue, of course, because she had a sister who had intellectual disabilities. But she grabbed the power of the Kennedy Foundation, which was the family's charitable organization. And she used that organization to spend millions of dollars of her father's money on research on this issue.
And you mentioned her sister, Rosemary. You know, of course, through the years, and you wrote about this in your book, but there was a little bit of, shall I say, pushback or different understanding of how the family treated Rosemary?
Well, Rosemary was born with mild intellectual disabilities. You can see that in films of the family back in the 30s when they were in London. She circulated at social parties all on her own. She was a very beautiful young woman. But her intellectual disabilities were compounded by mental health problems when she became a young woman. And her father made the tragic decision to have her lobotomized. And she lost her ability to walk and talk. Even worse than that, he banned his children from seeing their institutionalized sister. And those 20 years were lost. And I think Eunice, when she brought Rosemary back into the heart of the family, spent the rest of her life making up for that decision that her father made and that she and her siblings obeyed.
So it sort of became her driving vision.
It did indeed.
So I'm also curious what other protections we think of today as byproducts of Eunice Kennedy Shriver's political work.
The Americans with Disabilities Act that was passed in 1990, that doesn't exist without Eunice Kennedy Shriver. Lowell Weicker, the former senator from Connecticut and the former governor of that state, was one of the chief architects of it. And he told me during research for my biography of her that her fingerprints are all over that legislation. She made sure that children with intellectual disabilities, adults with intellectual disabilities, were covered by that law, as well as people with physical disabilities.
So, Eileen McNamara, let's bring it back to today, because you mentioned at the top that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos picked a fight with the wrong person, and you mean, you know, Eunice Kennedy Shriver here, even though she is no longer with us. So DeVos put out a statement defending her proposed cuts to the Special Olympics education program, saying in part, the Special Olympics is not a federal program. It's a private organization. She goes on to say that she loves their work and that she's personally supported its mission. But does she have a point there, Eileen, that the Special Olympics is a nonprofit organization and not a part of the Department of Education?
Well, it's true. There's no arguing with that. But that doesn't mean that the work they're doing isn't work that the federal government should be supporting. The anti-bullying campaigns, the work in schools, this is not a lot of money in the federal budget. I think it's small-minded to cut it out.
And you write in your Cognoscenti piece, Eunice Kennedy Shriver's son, Tim Shriver, he now runs the Special Olympics. We heard from him at the top of the show there in some tape. What lessons do you think he has learned about leading the Special Olympics from his mother, Eunice?
I mean, one of the things he learned is how to lobby Capitol Hill. Every time you win a victory on the Hill in an appropriation is a one-time victory. You have to go back year after year and fight to hold that line. And his mother taught him how to do that. She never rested on her laurels.
So in thinking about these cuts, we should say they might not ever happen. They're just part of the administration's proposed budget. And I should note they were also proposed in years past and rejected. So finally, Eileen McNamara, do you think these cuts this year will stand?
No, I don't think they'll stand. I think that what has caused people such anger about these cuts is not their expectation that they are going to happen, because I don't think they will happen. There is too much support for Special Olympics on Capitol Hill, bipartisan support for Special Olympics. I think this was a tone-deaf move, not the first one by the Trump administration and probably not the last.
And so, finally, do you think the legacy of Eunice Kennedy Shriver lives on today in Washington?
Oh, her spirit is hanging over the Capitol right this moment, and it is enraged. And I have to tell you, you do not want to be in the path of Eunice Kennedy Shriver when she was enraged.
Even years later. Well, that's Eileen McNamara. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and director of the journalism program at Brandeis University, and she's the author of Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World. Eileen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can find a link to Eileen McNamara's Cognoscenti piece at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll be joined by two of the 25 millennials of color influencing Boston's art scene. All this week, WBUR's arts team, The Artery, has been taking a look at 25 millennials of color who are bringing fresh new perspectives to Boston's art scene. Performance artist Tory Bullock is one of them. He's known for his viral videos where he takes on everything from the weather to race and real estate in Boston.
Boston, I'm gonna be real with you right now. I love you, girl, all right? And we've been in a relationship for like my entire life, but honestly, it's starting to feel like you're trying to push me away. But then when I try to walk away, you're sitting there, you're like, no, please don't go. All I see is all these studies and reports and companies being like, why are all the young professionals moving out of Boston? It's right there. It's your new dude. It's that new chick you're trying to be with right there. Boston, we've been together for a long time, girl. I want to know, will you give me some affordable rent?
And Tory Bullock joins us now in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for doing it. And I don't know if you found that rent yet, but we'll get to it in a second.
Oh, we haven't. Oh, I'll let you know.
We're also joined by Catherine Morris, who, while she's not an artist herself, has advocated for diversity and inclusion in the local art scene as founder and executive director of the Boston Arts and Music Soul Festival, better known as BAMS Fest. Catherine, thanks for being here as well.
Oh, I am truly happy to be here.
Well,
next
and
to my brother.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you both. And I just want to give folks a little taste of BAMS Fest, so let's hear a clip of Jamaica Plain rapper and producer Billy Dean Thomas performing at last year's festival.
Where? I
said dollar, 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 holla, dollar, 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 holla, say dollar, 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 in the dream. All I need is a dollar in the dream.
Sounds fun.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, yeah, let's start with this Artery 25 list. Why do you think it's important to shed light on this aspect, this part of the Boston art scene? Start with you.
Because people think that there's nothing going on in Boston. And when you bring up...
No fun Boston?
Yeah, no. When you bring up artists in Boston or the art scene in Boston, people are like, huh? Like, you guys play baseball, right? And then when you say, oh, no, let's talk about the black art scene or the people... I don't want to say black scene, but the...
Well, no, it's kind of true.
Okay,
it's
kind of true. Well, the people of color scene in Boston, when you bring that up to people, they're like, I didn't even know black people lived in Boston,
yeah,
let alone created art, so...
I mean, why do you think that is?
There's various reasons for that. I think for me, why I started what I wanted to do is because I looked at comparable cities that where arts and culture is a social norm. It is part of your lifestyle versus Boston making it a thing and very, very segregated about who has access to that thing. And so that is, I felt like that has penetrated down as to why arts and culture doesn't get the love it deserves, because we have not made it a part of who we are every single day. I think practicing artists do, but the community at large, stakeholders, funders, donors, very, very picky about where funds go to and who's promoted and who's not promoted.
So how do you think Boston compares to other cities like Chicago, LA, Philly?
If we are in the top 10 list, we're probably 11.
Mm.
In my opinion. Now, I've lived in Philly. I've seen festivals in North Carolina. I've gone to things in Florida. I've seen things in Detroit. They just kind of do it better, in my opinion. Even with little resources, but everyone knows about the arts and culture scene, it is just part of who they are every single day.
So then, Tori, what are those other cities doing better?
I think that it really is... It's a part of who they are. It's the arts feel like they're taken seriously. It feels like it's a part of just the more general discussions that are being had within all these cities. People are talking about the arts and like how important it is to education and how important it is to all these other things. And in Boston, it's seen as kind of a hobby. It's seen as something you do for fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cool thing you do after school, but it's not something that you do to really create change and really share your voice.
And you said a little earlier that, you talk about arts in Boston and particularly artists of color in Boston. You said other folks don't even know that there are black people living in Boston. Mm-hmm. And so building off of that is, I guess, race is at the core of so much in this city. But Boston's complicated history with race, is that part of this story?
Yeah, I just think that when Boston is a very specific thing to a very specific person, and we are sports, we are that pride, we are that love, but it's not love for everybody. It's love for that very particular type of Boston. Even people who come to Boston, they go to what they saw in the movies. They go to Charlestown, they go to, you know, Faneuil Hall, but they're not necessarily coming to all of Boston, you know? So I feel like there's kind of a national sentiment about what Boston is that we even believe ourselves.
So then, Catherine Morris, how what can we do as a city and a region to change that?
Ooh, that's a great question.
I know. How much time do we have?
I think at a political level, I think the mayor and governor need to come together and partner and take arts and culture seriously. And I know there's a variety of different bills, you know, happening and being passed. But comparatively to like Chicago and Philadelphia, the mayor and governors of those states have amplified and raised more public funding to support that. And we haven't done that here. Right. So there's that level of politics. I think the other thing is that venues that have been steeped in their history, their bias, their race, their racism, all those things, to me, they really have to modernize themselves. There's a lot of venues that were built for wind ensembles, but amplification is where it is. The way that theater is done, it is much more participatory than what the buildings were made for at the time. Things have to be modernized at this point. The generation is different. the tools and technology are different now, and a lot of venues can't even accommodate that. So often, arts practitioners, music practitioners have to be very creative about where they go, which is a great thing because it helps those redefine what space means to different audiences. But for the existing institutions, they really have to start changing their way of thinking about different genres, different art disciplines, and the audiences that are going to be here regardless whether you like them or not.
So, Catherine Morris, you're the founder and executive director of Boston Arts and Music Festival, BAMS Fest.
Yeah.
So, in talking about venues and thinking about venues, when you launched BAMS Fest, how did you think about venues? How did you pick a venue?
When it came to an outdoor space, I think I went to 16 different green spaces in the state. And there were some towns that didn't want us. They didn't want communities of color. They didn't want artists of color. And I said, okay, that's Boston. That's my state. And then I went kind of deeper into the neighborhoods that I grew up in and selected Franklin Park, just given its history over the last 30, 40 years being an epicenter for cultural exchange, celebrating different ethnicities and activities. It just made sense to be at Franklin Park. And then me standing on the shoulders of Elma Lewis and her legacy and literally.
And she had a playhouse in the park there, right?
Absolutely. And bringing the Duke Ellingtons and bringing the Charlie Parkers. A lot of that history has been forgotten. So BAMS Festival is really a 2.0 version of that in a way that brings all generations together, reintroduces our audiences to a variety of different genres and art disciplines in a way where they can define their own experience in a different green space that everyone knows.
And was it a challenge to launch a new music festival in Boston?
Absolutely. It's taken me 8 years to get this thing off the ground.
Wow.
I've gotten more no's than yeses. However, there have been a few people who have supported my vision because I've been consistent. And that is the thing in Boston. Once you lose consistency, you lose the faith of the people. So I did smaller events just to prove the fact that it's coming at some
point. Proof of concept.
Absolutely. And then being a Boston girl allowed me to kind of get through different social circles that otherwise would probably have said no to me. But consistency is key. And when you're present in the communities that you want to affect and they see you on a constant basis, they know you're for real and they actually might give you the time.
So this idea of lack of spaces or venues, do you think that's improving at all?
No.
Are you part of this improvement? No.
BAMS Festival, I think, is setting a benchmark of how you can use space in a very different way when you consider all the elements of the human experience for those who've been marginalized. That's a very different way of thinking. But also in the sense of venues, the very small ones that are trying, they don't get the support and funding that they need to really welcome all different art disciplines and music genres. I think it's the larger institutions that get the 97% of funding really got to modernize their stuff and not be afraid of change, really.
Well, speaking of change, Tori Bullock.
Yes, yes.
And venues. Boston is your venue. It's your canvas. It's everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, you film on the streets of Boston and that's where you do your art. And I'm wondering, thinking about venues, how did you decide to make that the space that you use?
Because there weren't any venues.
so you took them all.
Well, yeah, I just took it all. It really became a very interesting thing because I was like, oh, I want to shoot videos in Boston. And if you want to do something as simple as shoot videos in Boston, what does that actually mean? Well, I want to rent a space to shoot. What does that space have to look like? How big does that space have to be? Can I rent a space for an hour somewhere? Or do I have to commit myself to a week-long run of something? So because there was a lack of space, I just sat in my car, made a video. And then it just started to evolve into this thing where, like you said, the entire city is literally my set.
And you know, we heard at the top there, you know, luxury condos, you do videos walking down the street. And you remind us that even that simple act can be complicated walking down the street of a city. For example, I have a clip here from a couple of years ago. It's during the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, following the fatal police shooting of Michael Brown. And here's what you say about a man who walked by you.
He's walking toward me, and it's just me and him on the street. And he looks up at me and gives me the glance. We all know the glance. And then he immediately crosses the street and keeps walking. That story completely represented this entire Ferguson situation to me. The entire world is Ferguson. The entire world has been Ferguson for me and countless other African-American men since I was born.
So, for you, Is Boston Ferguson?
I think the world is still Ferguson. I mean, I don't know if people like know this or not, but the world is kind of can be a racist place and can be a kind of very judgy and not the best place for everybody who doesn't necessarily look like you. So yeah, for me, Boston is still that place that we're doing a little better with the support. But honestly, I like where we are because it's forcing artists to say, hey, yell and scream and to say, hey, I'm here. You should need to listen to me.
So you both are here. You're on the Artery 25 list. What do you hope to see in Boston's arts future?
Chaos, man. I want chaos in the best way. I just want to be a place where there's so much stuff happening.
Absolutely.
And so many different types of artists and so many different types of artwork just going on and really letting the rest of America and the world know that Boston is really a place to be because the artists are taking over, you know?
Catherine?
Absolutely. I think for me, I want the city and the state to be in a place where people, whether they're transplants or residents or permanent folks, to not look at it as where can I go where there are all the black and brown people, but rather what are you interested in? And let's find a place where you could potentially find folks that identify with you. I want to get to that point because we're in a time where a lot of people that come here are like, I want to go where all the black people are, all the Dominicans. I'm like, that's great, but that's not how the city is built right now. Mm-hmm. So I want to get to a place where it's more about interest specific versus race based.
And we're all aging. You'll be millennials forever. But how do you hope to inspire? I know we don't have a ton of time left. How do you hope to inspire the folks that come next?
I mean, for me, it's plant your seed and have many people invest in your legacy. And they will follow literally in those footsteps.
Yeah, Jordan. For me, it's knowing that you can do literally anything that you want to do. And all you have to do, you're walking around with a camera in your phone 24 hours a day. We're all creative. Find your voice and make some noise.
Well, thank you for sharing your voices here today. That's performance artist Tori Bullock and Catherine Morris. She's founder and executive director of Boston Arts and Music Festival. They're both part of the Artery 25. That's 25 millennials of color to watch in Boston Arts. You can meet the others at wbur.org/artery. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
So it's the Red Sox season opener and the official start to their title defense as they take on the Seattle Mariners tonight at T-Mobile Park. While the playoffs are several months away, it's never too early for Red Sox Nation to talk about another World Series title, even if the odds are against a repeat. WBUR's Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer looks at why it's so difficult to win back-to-back titles in Major League Baseball and whether the Red Sox can be the team to do it.
From the top on down, here comes a 1-2 pitch. Red Sox win the World Series!
The final out in Game 5 of the World Series. The champagne and beer-fueled celebration in the visitors' clubhouse at Dodger Stadium. And the duck boat parade from Fenway Park to Government Center. They're all vivid but distant memories now, but not too distant. The Red Sox success in 2018 fuels talk of another World Series championship in 2019. Lots of talk. Throughout spring training, questions about a repeat were asked in interview after interview. And the answers from players like designated hitter J.D. Martinez and pitchers Rick Porcello and Matt Barnes focused on how tough it is to win back-to-back titles.
Once you get into the playoffs, it's a different animal. You know, the timing's got to be right. Everyone's got to be clicking on the right cylinders. You know,
ball clubs that we're going to be playing are going to feel differently about playing us. We're going to have a bit of a target on our back. And
it's hard to win one, let alone win two, right? You got to have a good team. A lot of stuff's got to go your way, and you got to play consistently good baseball.
Repeat champions do happen. The last NBA team to repeat? Easy. The Golden State Warriors last year. The last NHL team? The Pittsburgh Penguins the year before that. NFL team? New England fans probably remember when the Patriots did it in 2005. But it's been almost 20 years since a team won back-to-back titles in baseball. In 2000, the New York Yankees finished a dynastic run with their third World Series win in a row. So what makes it tougher to repeat in Major League Baseball?
In baseball, you know, the best team does not always win. The hot team wins, and there's so many teams, the odds are against everybody.
That's Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy.
So you can be the most likely team to win, but you're still not likely to win. And I think that that's what everybody's up against. The Red Sox certainly feel good about themselves, but odds are they will not prevail when it comes to October.
The MLB season is excruciatingly long, 162 games spread over 6 months, and it wears down players. The team that's hot in June or July might be struggling and injury-riddled by September. Add in playoff baseball, and teams that compete in the World Series play a month longer than anybody else. That's a month of high-intensity, high-stress baseball. For pitchers, that could mean throwing an extra 20 to 25 innings with an already taxed arm. They may get a World Series ring, but then they get an off-season that's a month shorter.
So then you come back the following season, you're a little bit extra tired.
Jen McCaffrey covers the Red Sox for The Athletic.
You're kind of maybe trying to prove that you're, you know, the world champion and then kind of going out there and doing too much too soon and getting injured.
The good news? Red Sox manager Alex Cora thinks a lot about getting his players rest. He did it last season when the Red Sox set a franchise record for wins. And he's looking at the schedule this season with rest in mind.
We have a plan in place. Imagine this year when we play 11 in a row right away. But we have to take care of the players. It's not an easy season. We'll take advantage of the off days. We want these guys to be ready for the stretch run for October.
Another reason for guarded optimism when it comes to a Red Sox repeat? The team returns 20 of the 25 players on its World Series roster. With that number comes established team chemistry and valuable experience. The only potential downside? The Red Sox will keep getting asked a lot about last year.
That report from WBUR's Shira Springer. Ethan is a new documentary film that, over a decade, follows an Amherst family and their son with autism. The film offers a glimpse into the day-to-day joys and the struggles that come with raising a child with a disability. It's also a portrait of a very creative, lively, and fun-loving young man with his own vision for his future. Here's Ethan in the film, at 21 years old, laying out his goals for the year.
My vision statement by Ethan Floque. After I graduate from high school, I plan to continue to go to Brookdale's Music Academy and work at Prospect Meadows Farm. I also plan on living at home with my family as long as I can. I also have a girlfriend I'd like to add also.
And joining me from NEPR in Springfield is Ethan's mother, Cammie McGovern. She's an author and one of the founders of Whole Children and Milestones. It's a resource center for children and young adults with disabilities in Hadley, Mass. Cammie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is the filmmaker behind Ethan, Josephine Sittenfeld. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, Cammie, we heard at the top there Ethan laying out his vision for the future, but I'm wondering if you could tell us more about Ethan. What is he like?
Ethan is actually a very happy-go-lucky, pleased with himself, 22-year-old with autism and intellectual disability. And there's a lot of things he loves to do. And it's one of the nice parts about the movie is that they capture what so many autistic kids have, which is just passions for what they love. And for many parents early on, the grief you experience when your child has been diagnosed is mitigated by watching your child, following your child, those passions. And they will take you to train stations and radio museums and the strangest places on earth. So it is one of the paths to a full life, I think, embracing all those passions. And Ethan's our music and farm equipment, collecting business cards. And actually, I would say he's a very social fellow, even though socializing is hard for him. So he loves family, neighbors, friends, and community.
And the film really does capture that joy that that Ethan has. And just for folks listening who aren't familiar with autism, could you just explain how it affects him?
It's a spectrum disorder, as many people know, so it's capable of being very high-functioning, as they say, and you're very verbal and very, very capable in certain areas. The defining link is difficulty in processing, in social engagement often, and processing communication often. And all of those things are a challenge for Ethan. And Ethan is somewhere in the middle towards the less verbal side.
And Joe, you capture that in the film, and you filmed this family when Ethan was a child back in 2007, and then you returned when he was an adult a decade later. And I'm wondering what compelled you to tell Ethan's story.
So I had worked at a special needs school outside of Washington, D.C., right out of college, and I worked with kids on the autism spectrum. And I sat in on IEP meetings, and I was super aware of just the intensity of the parents' experience, sort of just going through a lot and lots of joys and lots of struggles at home with their kids. So a few years later, I decided to do a photo project about children on the autism spectrum and their families. And I reached out to Cammy, who's a friend of my sister's. And I said, you know, can I come out? Can I take pictures of Ethan? And Cammy said, sure, come on out. And I just sort of fell in love with him and with their family right away. And I took photos and I came back, and one of my friends, I was saying, oh my God, he's so funny and he sings and he's like, he had these funny nicknames. And my friend was Maureen, was looking at the photos, and she said, you know, these are nice images, but they certainly don't capture the stories that you're telling about Ethan's. And she said, you should pick up a video camera. And so I did. And here we are, you know, 12 years later.
Well, so to that point in the film, we see Ethan as a child, and his behavior and his interests, you know, they didn't strike me as radically different from his other two brothers, Henry and Charlie. But then when you return 10 years later, that difference does kind of come into a clearer focus. And Cammy, we hear from your other two sons on how they view their role in Ethan's life moving forward in that future that Joe was just talking about.
Someday, me and my brother Charlie are going to have to take care of him a little bit more and keep him under control. I don't think he's going to change that much from here on out.
I think that's Charlie's.
My parents are still really, really important in his life because he still needs to learn how to, you know, cut steak and, you know, it's like, you know, cook food that isn't nachos and cook food that isn't, you know, kind of simple. He can brush his own teeth. He's not great at that, but he can.
A moment there for...
Oh, we have to pause for laughter.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a moment there from the new documentary, Ethan, and we're joined by Ethan's mother, Cammy McGovern, and filmmaker Josephine Sittenfeld. Cammy, you folks were laughing there at that clip, but I'd imagine that this is the type of conversation and conversations that families are having, and I'm just wondering, have you as a family talked with Henry and Charlie about their role in Ethan's future?
Oh, it's an amazing it's an amazing question, and it's actually very touching. It tears me up a little bit to hear them talk about it. I think one thing I've always said in my mind is that in some ways helping a special needs sibling has more benefits than difficulties, because you are coming of age and seeing how hard certain things are, and it builds empathy and it builds confidence. And then there's this other side at the other end that we have not talked a great deal about what would be their future responsibility, except to say it's not going to be your responsibility. But there it is anyway. They're thinking about it, and this is going to be an ongoing conversation for every family with an autistic member, is what does the future look like, and who's going to shape, because they will be part of his future. They will be part of – it will fall to them.
Yeah, and there's that anxiety, is you can feel it in portions of the film about the future. And I have another clip here of your husband Mike as he reflects on this.
I must admit, I sometimes think what he's going to do when we're gone, you know, when he's 59, what's that going to be about?
And so, Cammy, now that Ethan's an adult, do you still share some of those same concerns?
Oh, absolutely. This is what this generation is facing, and what every family and what every parent is facing, is that there are no clear answers on this. And in some ways, Ethan's generation is the luckiest of historically, because starting in 1990, but it wasn't until 1990 that there was mainstream inclusive education guaranteed for all people with developmental, with all disabilities. And yet it's very unclear what's going to become of them, because we're still at the beginning of figuring out what jobs can they get. At this point, the 16 to 21-year-olds, there's almost a million coming of age in this country over the next 5 years. And right now, the statistics have been that only 15% will find jobs. They'll be better prepared for a future that's going to be very hard for them to attain. So what does a happy life look like? It's not going to be jobs for a lot of them. And so independent living and living without your parents or without your siblings helping you is the great challenge for this, for families coming up. And hopefully we'll meet that challenge. Like, Whole Children was part of figuring out how to set up what didn't already exist, and we need to keep doing things like that.
And of course, you mentioned Whole Children Milestone Center. That's the center that you work with in Hadley, Massachusetts, which provides services for children with disabilities. And I'm wondering, so I'm glad you brought this up, because resources is a big issue for families, you know, writ large. And I'm just wondering what you say to families or parents who might have other financial challenges and are also trying to meet the needs of a child with disabilities.
I think in Massachusetts, the good news is that we guarantee day programming, that the education, by and large, is very good here. And also, what's very unusual about Massachusetts is the adult services. If you qualify for DDS or Department of Developmental Services, as an adult turning 22, you will get some type of day services or day support. And that is not true for the vast majority of this country, that people get to age 22, they age out of their federally funded school programming, and the school bus doesn't show up, and they have nowhere to go, and they're on a wait list for many places for between 7 to 10 years. And Massachusetts, you can still have somewhere to go, which is crucial, essential. What we don't have too many options on is any kind of independent living. Right now, it seems to be that the approach is everybody can just be okay living with their parents in order to just keep that going down the line. But it means we're kicking that can down the line 30 or 40 years. It's funny that Mike picked the age 59, because that's about when everything falls apart for these people if we haven't set up something before that.
Yeah. So Joe, I want to turn to you here. The film is very sort of slice of life. It feels like you're watching maybe some family home videos at certain points. It's very intimate. There are routine moments. And I'm curious, from your perspective as a filmmaker, what the story you were trying to tell.
Actually, when I started this film, there was a film about a boy who's dad takes him to a shaman in Mongolia, and he sort of heals him, and he leaves his autism behind. That, I mean, it's an amazing film, but you know, Ethan had interest in music and in farm machinery when he was 11, and he still has those same interests. But again, he is fundamentally very much the same person, with the same sense of humor and the same interesting ways of talking. And for me, the coming of age story, like, I think anyone going through adolescence, it's fascinating and crazy the way we all change. And so I was interested in telling that story.
I think I think that's what she's ended up with is here's what he looked like as a 9-year-old, mm-hmm. and here's how it turned out. And what I like about that is he's not too different. There were no magical transformations or great acquiring of surprise new abilities. There was a just maturing into who he had always been all along. And the stories that often get told are the kids that transformed miraculously. And those are so rare that it's kind of reassuring to see a reasonably happy story that isn't that.
Yeah, and I love this idea that Ethan is very much Ethan. And you see that throughout the film, even opening and him showing his collection of stickers on his door. And we wanted to speak with Ethan today, actually. We wanted to join us, wanted him to join us, but he's busy at his day programs. And so, Cammy, I'm curious, has he seen the film and what's his reaction been to it all?
He loves it all. Maybe I should have brought him because he loves being the center of attention.
Who doesn't?
And loves, he'll be who doesn't? And some love it more than others. But he will be at the screening and answering questions. And so he has no self-consciousness. And that's one of the great gifts of so many kids with disabilities is they leap for the spotlight and the center stage. And I'm here and I'm different and I'm fabulous.
So I remember last year I showed a rough cut at a Whole Children event. And Ethan said, you know, I'm really excited, but I just want to talk about, are we going to have merch? Like he wanted to have kind of like the band
t-shirts
and stickers and postcards. And so, and I was like, okay, he's so on board. We don't have as much merch as we might.
Well, it does fit in. I feel like that makes sense because I have another cut here from the film and he loves business cards. So that fits in with the merch category, right? And in this clip, he actually is showing off his own business card for his lawn mowing business.
What does it say on it?
Ethan's Lawn Service, Ethan's Okay, lawn stylist. Inspective.
No, innovative.
Innovative. Prompt and innovative.
No, wait, sorry. Okay, so it says inexpensive.
Inexpensive, prompt, and innovative.
But isn't that a nice car?
Yeah.
It really is a nice card, and he you could see that he loves it so much.
And his mom loves it
and
so
his
much.
Mom does.
That was his big Christmas present, was a box of 1,000 of those.
So, Cammy, at the top we heard about Ethan's goals list from 2017, and he's 22 now, so what are some of Ethan's goals for this year?
One thing is, so at the farm, he had never driven a zero-turn lawnmower.
And those are hard.
Those are hard. I couldn't do a zero-turn lawnmower. And so I haven't actually seen it, but his crew captain said, you know, he can do this better than I can now. He drives it right up on the truck and stops on a dime.
So is that the message then that, you know, in telling your family story this way that you're trying to impart?
Oh, I would say they will continue to surprise you. And Ethan has continued to surprise us. I also want it to be clear that none of this was easy and there were we focused a lot on the positives. It was a long journey, and especially in the throes of teenagehood when it was perhaps just find that Joe was visiting us less because there were some dark patches of Ethan failing at one job after another and saying he wanted to do something and then showing up at work and announcing he'd quit, which he was allowed to do, and not being a good hard worker, not being pleasant to be around, and not being positive and affable. So I think that's an important piece of the story, too. And you'll see him be very uncharming in the movie. But believe me, there were years of that.
Well, I think any teenager, any parent with teenagers can relate to that, right? It's a hopeful message. And so thank you for bringing it to us.
Oh, thank you.
That's Cammy McGovern. She's an author and co-founder of Whole Children and Milestones, a resource center for children and young adults with disabilities in Hadley, Massachusetts. Cammy, thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
And Josephine Sittenfeld, a filmmaker and photographer. Her short film, Ethan, about Cammy's family and her son with autism, will be screening at the Real Abilities Film Festival next week. There's more information about it on our website, radioboston.org. Josephine, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Let's go out on Ethan's own rendition of Old Crow Medicine Show's song Wagon Wheel, which is featured in the film. That's Radio Boston for today. We're a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, Chris Siderick, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skoll is our technical director. We had engineering today by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna. Thanks for listening. And please join us again tomorrow for another edition of Radio Boston.